Patrick, are you done eating yet? That sound is driving me crazy.
Sorry, Nick. I'm just enjoying a nice bowl of Snap, Jangle, and Pop. All right. Happy Monday, everybody. It's Patrick here on Rockin' the Suburbs. I hope everybody had a great weekend. I am sitting down in my own basement today. Not by myself, though.
Hey, it's Nick Scalera.
Hey,
long Nick. Time friend of the pod.
So, it's springtime, Nick. You know this, right? We were just talking about the weather and our allergies.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim is dealing with the parental rite of springtime, which happens around this year, which is college choice. So
indeed.
He has been, touring the Northeast and the part of the South to try to make a decision for his daughter. And so we're going to do something we've been kind of talking about for a while, right? We've been tossing around the idea of opening up a history of Flying Nun Records, one of our all-time favorite musical labels.
Exactly. I've been lobbying these guys going back to the old podcast, I think.
I think you
pretty
have.
Nonstop.
And so this worked out really well. And I got to give you the scene down here, people. We got vinyl piled everywhere. We got just ashtrays overflowing. We got typewritten pages stained with coffee. You know, our sleeves are all rolled up. It's
raining just like Dunedin.
Yeah, exactly. The ambiance is beautiful. So, we hope that we've done a good job, and Nick, I want to thank you for preparing these notes, you know, which I think are gonna ride us through this week, and we're gonna start with kind of the origin story of Flying Nun, kind of as we put it together, right? Kind of what it was, right. What had happened, because I imagine there are people out there that may know the name, but may not be necessarily completely familiar with any of the groups or anything like that, right? So we're going to try to open that up a little bit for you.
Exactly. I mean, it was a small scene, but very influential. And, you know, we've been talking quite a bit now in here about how we actually came to hear these bands, which back in the world, you know, pre-internet.
Yes.
Getting a hold of these recordings was not easy, and sort of getting an awareness of a music scene that started, you know, way down the Southern Hemisphere, 18 hours ahead of time, everything else.
It's kind of crazy.
I'm kind of, every once in a while, I'm like, how did this even happen?
Yeah. And so before we jump in, and we're both going to tell our origin stories, which I think will be really great, I want to do something, a business matter here as he shuffles papers. I want to thank all of our guest hosts from last week. We had five guest episodes created for us while Jim and I were on a little spring break, and we really, really appreciate everything. I want to thank Craig Rosen from beautiful Porter Ranch, California. He updated us on his dog's broken toe, Milo. Get better fast.
Poor puppy.
Yeah. His mother-in-law, which was a great, some background, because we gave him a little stick for that incident when he was cleaning his pool deck, his mother-in-law's pool. He cleared up the Donald Trump REM End of the World as You Know It thing, which was kind of interesting, you know, because Echo Park Jimmy was convinced that somehow they'd, from the past, said something about Donald Trump in there. Mm. And so we got into that a little bit, told a great story about L7, told a really funny story about his interview with Perry Farrell and Courtney Love, too, which was really good. Eric Didrikson, I don't know how much music this guy listens to, but I mean, he opened up the first quarter of 2018 with like five records that he really liked, and I never heard of any of these bands. Wow. It's amazing. And there was one that really has become a favorite of mine. I hope other people liked it too. Crew Angbin, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a trio from Texas, I think Houston, who do kind of like, they're influenced by like 60s Thai music.
Thai.
Yeah, it's instrumental.
Not food.
Stuff. No, the music. It's quite crazy. BJ Bonin and Amy Waller talked about the cello. That was a great episode. It was kind of a riff on our French horn episode. And Jim's friend Mike White took us back to Rockford radio days, and he did a whole thing on some favorite songs of his, which was really kind of cool. It was like listening to a really awesome college radio station again, and that was great. Thanks, Mike. And Mike didn't mention this, but he plays music occasionally with a band called the Blind Robins. So Jim told me about that. Mike was very humble. Anyway, thanks, guys. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have a chance to do that again. That was really fun. Okay, well, let's get into this. It's gonna be a lot of fun. I hope we turn a lot of people on to Flying Nun. Nick, tell me how you got into the label.
Flying Nun, you know, I guess it's a pretty typical story, but I'll tell it anyway. Okay. You know, if you're lucky enough in college to get cool friends, which somehow I happen to luck into that, who have record collections that are amazing. And I really got introduced to this from a few housemates of mine back in college in the late 80s. Yep. And, you know, also I got involved with the college radio station. And, you know, we were talking about this earlier, just the fact that there were some, you know, independent American labels that were putting out this music from New Zealand that just sounded absolutely amazing to me. And, you know, I come from a place of being a big 60s, you know, Beatles, Birds kind of fan. And I really was attracted to the jangly guitars. Yep. And the great rhythms and the very, very quirky lyrics and that odd sensibility that we will talk about. You know, once you sort of, you know, dip your toe in the pool with Flying Nun, there's a lot of depth there. And there's this whole scene of bands going back, you know, starting in the late 70s, right up through the 90s, that just put out some amazing, you know, album after album is a classic. So that's sort of my story about that. But yeah, it's been a lifelong passion for me, and I hope that comes through, you know, so.
It's interesting to me, because I had kind of the same experience, you know, obsessively, as I've talked about on the show many times, trying to uncover something that my friends didn't know about, you know, that was even cooler, but also, you know, investigating it. And I used to get a magazine called Forced Exposure magazine. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I read a review of Chill's album that had been reissued on Homestead Records. And I already liked all the stuff I heard and saw on Homestead. Just started from there. And there was something immediately both mysterious and familiar about the Chills when I first heard them. You could tell it came from somewhere else, right? The sensibilities were not American sensibilities, but they understood the American sensibilities. Like, all that classic garage rock was definitely there, and the Velvet Underground was there, and, you know, all kinds of stuff was there. And that led to going to the post office and getting a lot of money orders, which is what you did back then.
Suspicious.
And, yeah, exactly. And cashier's checks and things like that, and sending them all the way across the world to a place that I had formed a picture of in my mind. And some of these bands that I got into, certainly the Verlaines, the Clean was another big one. And I was, as you can see over there, we both brought in a lot of our Flying Nun stuff. But for a while, I was buying tapes because the shipping was so much cheaper, right? Oh, you got it on cassette? Definitely. I can get two then instead of one. So, yeah, I think we have pretty similar kind of origin discovery stories with this stuff, right?
And it's interesting because it's the music didn't hit everywhere in the world, and it had some real trouble in England.
Yeah.
Sort of catching on. But so the American strange college rock scene keyed into this, you know, in a way that that was pretty unique compared to the rest of the world. And I think some of the infrastructure of college rock helped there. I mean, it's not a thing that really existed as much in the UK. No. And, you know, things like College Music Journal is another sort of thing that we read. And you know, they'd also have a live show in New York and bring these bands in. So the U.S. connection to the Kiwis is an interesting connection.
It really is.
And a lot of the bands were surprised how successful they were when they would show up in the U.S. and there'd be an audience.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Other places, not so much.
Right. And so strange, like you said, about London and how it was very difficult for any of those bands to really catch on there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It was difficult to penetrate that wall of hype.
Exactly.
Now, there was a punk scene in New Zealand in the late 70s, like a lot of places. I mean, what would you say that was based on?
I think there's a bit of there's kind of a skip in the record there. There's this sort of attraction to a lot of the stuff in the 60s. And to me, when it comes to the Velvets, it's really that third album.
Oh, yeah.
it's sort of like clearly it was a big influence on this sound. That being said, you know, there were traditional, I guess, as we would say, bands trying to be punk bands in New Zealand, as there were everywhere in the world in the late 70s. But the sensibility is different and the influences are a little bit different. But there was a time when punk bands were trying to be punk in New Zealand. And I don't and if you've, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about The Enemy and Toy Love, which are sort of The Enemy is sort of the proto, you know, Flying Nun band in a lot of ways. And what we'll, as we go through this, you'll see a lot of these. There's a lot. It's a small scene. So a lot of guys and women move from band to band band.
Mm-hmm.
But The Enemy was sort of a traditional kind of punk band. And Chris Knox was leader of The Enemy. Chris Knox will come up a lot in this story.
He will.
And
he's kind of the godfather of Flying Nun in many ways. Yeah,
he's huge there.
Yeah.
But you know, and it's hard to get your hands on recordings of The Enemy. I've heard a few things here and there.
I love the song. She's the famous for singing her own approach. She's a lovely woman, so I love her so much. But she needs to find out the plan. But she needs to put her in jail. And we feel like we have a child. And she don't want to leave her alive. I want to die with you.
You know, it does sound pretty much like your basic punk kind of thing. You know, very loud, noisy. And, you know, Chris Knox was known for his stage antics.
He was.
You know, it very Iggy-like kind of, you know, cutting himself up and bleeding on the audience,
yes,
a lot of that kind of
right.
stuff. So the punk sensibility
his
was
face
there.
In like gauze, right?
Right,
when
exactly.
he sang, yeah.
yeah, yeah. So I mean, I think the sort of again the punk spirit is there.
Yeah.
The music, you know, just sort of speaks to me. The influences speak a little bit more that sort of 60s psychedelia, U.S. garage bands, even Big Star.
Right,
you know,
I would say that's true. Yeah,
you know, so it was a different sort of, you know, scene.
Have you ever been to New Zealand?
I have never been.
Okay, I've never been there either, but because of the amount of music I've listened to that was created there, there's geographically there's kind of a south and north part of the country, right? And there's differences
right
between those two, right?
It's pretty stark. And you know, I've done enough reading about this. I mean, it would surprise anyone from the outside, but you know, there's two islands in New Zealand, right?
Right.
So you got the North Island, you got the South Island. The North Island is where, you know, Auckland and Wellington are, which pass for big cities.
Yeah, those are the big ones.
Right.
Right.
The South Island is where Dunedin and Christchurch are, which were sort of the centers of the Flying Nun sound.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the South Island is you know, a bit more laid back, less urbane.
Yeah.
Right? Hard to imagine in a place as small as New Zealand.
Right.
But this is, you know, the Flying Nun bands and, you know, there's a lot of stories and interviews and books out there. But this is a big deal, this North-South split.
Yeah.
And also, the New Zealand Australia split is a
well.
Big
that's the
deal
other
well,
thing, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Australia sort of being the sort of, you know, the behemoth Right. Again, you know,
the giant shadow that's constantly cast.
Right, yeah. Right. The sort of being the little brother to Australia.
Right.
And also in the music business, that had a big impact too. I mean, if there were the label, major labels that did exist were in Australia.
Right.
Right.
You
know, so there was always a sense of whether bands would need to sort of make it there first. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was going to bring up, and I don't think it's a surprise to anyone who's into alternative music, but, you know, record stores are a big part of this, this story, a huge part of this story. And I actually had an experience as well going back to, you know, discovering these bands was knowing an older guy that was, you know, had a really cool record store. It's like, hey, check this out. Check this out. In Dunedin, which is in the South Island, where, where a lot of this music starts, there's this pretty famous record store called Records Records.
Yeah.
Right. And there's this guy, Roy Colbert, who really is just cited by every musician as being a huge influence. And, you know, he wasn't a producer, he wasn't making music, but he was hooking these young guys up with you know, a lot of this sort of cool music that influenced them, and also, you know, introducing them to each other.
You should know so and so who also is into that band. Just like the guy behind the counter, you know, making a huge difference. It's really important.
It's an amazing, it's an interesting story. He died recently, and you know, there's just some of the stories about the tributes that some of these guys did to him. It's a huge. There's a lot of sort of bit players in this story that have a big piece. But Roy Colbert is someone I wanted to bring up at the beginning, and also just the record stores in general. Now Dunedin, where you know we'll talk specifically about the Dunedin sound. Yeah. That's what all Flying Nun bands were tagged with as a moniker at one point. But, you know, Dunedin was also a university town.
Yes.
University of Otago.
Right.
Right. You know, not well known. I don't have any sweatshirts that say that. But it was a university town. And that was, you know, that had a big influence on the scene and on people sort of, you know, having eclectic tastes and being slightly more literate maybe than the rest of the population. So that's another piece of it.
And Roger Shepherd. We'll introduce him here at this point. He was also working in a record store early on, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Roger Shepherd is sort of, you know, this is the real origin story. This is the, you know, the Moses of this music, I guess, bring it to the people. And, you know, it's like it's kind of a classic story of a guy that just became obsessed with seeing a bunch of bands around town, which is basically what he was doing.
Yeah.
And a lot of these bands that were springing up out of this post-punk movement in New Zealand, they were playing at clubs all over the place, but they, you know, no one recorded this. You know, in a way, this is sort of like, it reminds me of, you know, back in the day where, when the folkways used to go out into the countryside and record, you know, blues musicians.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was sort of Roger Shepherd's sort of thing is, like, you know, I love these guys. I see them play live. I saw Toy Love, you know, and the Enemy. He was obsessed with the Enemy.
Yeah.
But I, you know, no one can hear them. What can we do about it?
Right.
And, you know, so he's like, okay, well, I'll just do something about it, essentially.
Yeah.
You know,
there's literally no record when people come in to buy it.
Right, there isn't
one. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, so Roger Shepherd, who was also working in a record store, as we mentioned, you know, just sort of kind of start shaking the trees about how do I, you know, can I get these guys recorded? Can I get them on tape?
Yeah.
And can we get them out there so that other people can listen to? And I mean, really, it's very much the story of I'm going to do what I'm passionate about and what I like, and I hope other people like it.
Yeah.
But in the end, I don't actually really care.
Yeah. If they do or not.
And a lot of the bands would accuse him of not caring so much later on that these things would get heard by anyone else.
But certainly you're right, I think, in the sense that he didn't really have much of a plan beyond let's get these 300 people, you know, that might be into this band or come to these shows to have something to listen to, a document to take home.
Almost like a souvenir.
Yeah,
like I want to take something home from the show,
right?
You know, other than a t-shirt.
Right. And what year are we talking about here, Nick? We're like 78, 79, somewhere
late
in there?
Late 70s.
Okay.
You know, and that's sort of, again, that is in the heyday of Chris Knox and Toy Love, which we can kind of sort of like transition because they sort of become the first band that's going to be heard in one way or another. So Roger Shepherd was obsessed with this band called The Enemy. And also that band later transitioned into Toy Love, you know, which is more of a prototypical, in a way, Flying Nun band. It still doesn't sound a lot like the stuff we'll talk about later, but this is the sort of the progenitor.
I'm lying in the hospital room. Several million miles away. I wanna be 6'3". I want a brighter sun.
And so, you know, Shepard really wanted to get Toy Love recorded. And that really led him to the you know, let's start a label, let's get it done.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe we should listen to something from Toy Love. Yeah, I think it's, you know, although I will set it up with a caveat.
Okay.
A song that we have queued up here is the fact that Chris Knox, who's the leader of Toy Love, was very unhappy with this recording.
Yeah.
It wasn't done by Flying Nun.
No.
Actually.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. He got involved with Warner Brothers, I think the Australian arm of Warner Brothers. And all the people in the band were pretty key, but Alec Bathgate was a guitarist in the band as well, a bass player. Paul Keane, Mike Dooley was the drummer, and Jane Walker was the keyboard player, but they were a little bit different sounding than the Enemy. So yeah, it's almost new wavy.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
It doesn't sound punk to me.
No,
and it doesn't sound raw. And that was one of the issues that Chris Knox had specifically with this recording that was done by a quote unquote major label in Australia, was that it was cleaned up, it was prettified, it was produced. The elements are there though.
Yeah,
You know,
it's a great song.
It's a great song. I mean, it sounds a lot more like some of the later Flying Nun bands than it does like and the Enemy.
No,
for
exactly
example,
right.
Or the sort of the rougher punk stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, when you talk about sort of quirky lyrics and the bouncy, there's a little bit of jangle in there, and the organ is it's pretty pronounced in the sound as well.
It really is.
And you come out of that song being what is going on? What are they talking about?
Yeah.
What's going on?
And you do get Chris's, idiosyncratic delivery right everywhere across that record, right? Which later would become even more eccentric and kind of out there.
Right. I think that for a long time, I did not know that was actually titled Swimming Pool. I wasn't sure what that word was he was saying.
This is pretty rapid fire.
But, you know, going on with Chris Knox sort of being a big part of the story, you know, when this recording came out and they were very upset with it, as we talked about before, but Chris basically took matters into his own hands at this point and said, you know what? I'm going to start doing this stuff myself. And this DIY mentality is a big piece of the Flying Nun story.
It really is.
A big piece.
You know, and I'm not sure. It was Chris and a guy named Doug Hood. Is that right?
Yep.
Who kind of went in and bought that first four-track tape machine.
The legend is that Chris inherited it from a dead relative.
Well,
he inherited some money from a relative.
Okay.
And sort of turned that around. They hadn't made much money, obviously.
Interesting.
His toy love. but he went and bought a secondhand Teac 4-track. And, you know, I don't know, maybe we should chat a little about 4-tracks. Because, you know, back in the day when, you know, in college radio, like a lot of guys on campus had a 4-track and there were bands starting to set up. And I'm sure you probably had
some experience. I got one in my closet.
Right.
So. And it comes in the little suitcase.
Right.
I think it's a Tascam or something like that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
But, you know, so this is sort of... You know, Chris Knox is like, all right, I got the 4-track. We're going to do this the way we want to do it, warts and all.
Yeah.
It's going to sound real. It's going to sound authentic. It's not going to be a producer. Doug Hood's going to be the producer.
Yeah.
You know, when Doug Hood basically was the sound man for Toy Love.
Right.
He sat out in the back and did the dials.
More the engineer than anything else,
right. Yeah. And so he ends up being sort of a big piece, a lot of these early recordings as well. So.
And, you know, from what I understand, and I've seen Chris play a few times and spoke to him once for a few minutes after a show. He has a personality that really was pretty polarizing, right?
Right.
I mean, he was not afraid to tell people what he thought and also say things to them just to see how they would react.
Right.
Like, he was one of those people that would put you on the spot, and if he saw you apparently getting uncomfortable, he would just dig that much harder to, you know. So he was definitely a galvanizing force.
He was. And you know, I think, again, that sort of gets back to this punk spirit to me. Like, I'm going to get in your face about stuff,
exactly.
Which he did with a lot of these bands. And in some cases, that kind of, you know, produced gold. In other cases, it produced folks that were pretty angry at Chris Knox for one reason or another. He had a very strong vision. You either liked it or you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he'd come right up to bands and basically say, you know, we just did that sucked. It was terrible, you know. And so that's not something that some of these bands wanted to hear. And it's interesting because Chris Knox is... that attitude is a little bit outside what the sort of scene was, which was a lot of cooperation, a lot of camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
But Chris Knox, as you said, was a polarizing figure. He was a love-hate kind of relationship with all his bandmates and all the other bands.
Yet he was able to coax these great performances in the early days out of these bands because of that, just being there, you know, having Doug and Chris record these records.
Yeah. And sort of the most, you know, really the big proto recording that we should talk about that Chris Knox did is that first EP by The Clean.
That's right.
The Clean is made up of Hamish and David Kilgour.
Right. Okay.
David was on guitar and Hamish was on drums. But Shepherd really got into The Clean.
Yeah.
And he saw The Clean open up in 1978 for The Enemy, doing like two or three songs.
Yeah.
Very rough, unpolished.
And they were playing early on, but literally just came out of the basement. Right.
Right. Yeah. And he was just amazed. He was like, well, this, you know, the thought was this band can actually, people need to hear these guys.
Yeah.
And I want to figure out a way to make it happen. As it happened, it didn't really work right away. It was a couple of years later that he finally approached The Clean.
Hit the formula.
Yeah, essentially. And he basically went up to them, as I understand, after a show, and was like, I want to record you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know? And that's where the first Flying Nun single comes. Well, the second Flying Nun single, actually. But the first one that made any difference was a song called Tally Ho that was released in 1981, I believe. Roger Shepherd convinced them to go to a studio in Christchurch, an actual studio, which is kind of surprising when you hear the thing. It was done in a studio.
It wasn't on the 4-track.
It was in a studio. $50 was the cost of recording that.
Wow.
It was kind of an instant hit, so to speak. It reached 19 on the New Zealand charts, which was a big deal at the time. Sort of put the label on the map.
That
right?
blows my mind. So I think that's something, you know, we'll see as we go through this story. But these records actually charted in kind of this New Zealand chart.
Right.
Now, obviously, it's a different, smaller world we're talking about, but they would, I mean, a record like Tally Ho, that sound right there was on a top 20 hit.
Right.
Like,
right.
What kind of world?
You know, they got no radio play, which will be no surprise to anybody. Zero radio play outside of the college radio scene, mm-hmm. which was also going on in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these hits that managed to get up to 19 or 12 or 5, it was word of mouth. It was, you know, getting a bunch of records in a van and taking them up to record shops. And it was this sort of, you know, again, pre-internet, but really just getting the word out there that these are great bands and these things selling, in some cases faster than they can make them. After Tally Ho, again, there was a feeling of, well, we weren't happy with this recording. And if you listen to it, that first recording is what transition for them for that, put an EP, mm-hmm. which again, maybe a concept we should talk about. EPs
yeah.
were something that most Americans don't really get. And even going back to the days of the Beatles, there were, you know, the EP was not something that worked in the American market.
No, it never did. And the Beatles did put out a lot of them because it was a convenient way to get like four or five songs that were short enough. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that worked really well for these New Zealand bands.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. They could maximize their time when they were recording and they had and could essentially put it out for not much more money than a 7-inch, or sometimes they were 7 inches.
True. Yeah. True. You know, and so, so this first EP that, you know, this, that the Clean did was called Boodle, 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 mm-hmm. which apparently Boodle is some reference to money. Not that they made that much money, but that's what I've heard anyway. This was when Chris Knox went to the Clean and said, hey, why don't we do this the way I want to do this?
Yeah.
Right. And
you didn't like it the first time. I had a bad experience with Toy Love.
Right. Yeah. I was, you know, he was scarred by the professionalism. The Clean wasn't happy with that first single. He said, let's do it my way. And his way was that TX 4-track machine.
Mm-hmm.
And, they rented a shack in Auckland. And I mean, I've seen a photo. Have you seen the photo?
I've seen the photo in Roger's book. Yeah.
It looks like,
you have to crouch down to go in just to be in there.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of like the thing in my backyard where the lawnmower and the rakes are. You
exactly.
know? That's sort of the look and the size of it. You know, it was the Legion of Frontiersmen Field Headquarters was the name of this place. Anyway, there was some magic going on in that shack. You know,
absolutely. Yeah, there was something. And I don't know what they put on the walls.
Know it was recorded on a 4-track in a shack. It sounds pretty fresh to me. I know they, you know, that maybe there's one or two instruments on one track and there's some mixing down going on, but boy, it sounds great.
For a trio, they would sometimes not have a guitar on some of their songs. It would be a keyboard, bass, and drums, right? Which was really kind of a cool thing.
You know, this EP really was, I guess, huge by New Zealand terms.
Yeah, oh,
it was huge for the label.
It was a big breakthrough. Actually allowed them to pay for many more recordings, right?
And as the story goes on, it's very much hand-to-mouth at Flying Nun. Mm-hmm. You know, you get something out there, you make some sales, you can put something else out.
Right.
It literally was like money in, money out.
First nonstop. One pays for the next one, right? That's the way.
This is DIY. Yeah. We the Clean have our vision. Chris Knox will say whatever he's going to say. but that's it. There's no one else. There's no interceding force. It's going to sound the way we want it to sound.
I'm not sure when you read Roger Shepherd's book, but he has an autobiography. One of the things to me that was so amazing is that he wasn't a label owner, you know, like David Geffen or, you know, somebody like that. He just kind of was there, you know, and he supported it and he let him, in some cases, do insane artwork and, you know, whatever kind of crazy packaging they wanted to do.
I mean he was the number one fanboy, which is problematic for the boss in some ways.
It caused him a few problems later on down the road.
It did cause problems, but, you know, his passion and his love for this music extended to a certain extent letting the bands do, you know, the whole nine yards on this, the artwork, you know, what do you want to put on the cover? What do you want to put on the actual little thing in the middle? Right.
Exactly. You know? Oh, you got a friend who draws? Sure. It's amazing.
Right.
Another record that came out, after that probably was even more of an influential record, would you say, in some ways, because it kind of stuck to the EP format, but in a different way. It actually was had four bands on it.
Right. It's an odd thing. And again, from an American standpoint, it's hard to imagine a four-sided EP with four different bands.
In the early 80s? Like, right. Who in the world would ever think that was a good idea?
It's very odd. It's a bit foreign. But, you know, it's a concept that really worked in the end because it introduced, you know, four bands that weren't really that well known at the time other than outside the scene.
Yeah.
All of them get a side of
two
this EP.
12-inch 45 or 33 EPs, right?
Right, right. Yeah. They all get a side. The Dunedin double EP is what it's called.
Yep.
And this, for better or worse, is where the term Dunedin sound comes from.
Right.
I think, from my opinion, and I don't know if you'd agree, but like if there wasn't a sound, I wouldn't have been into it.
Well, that's exactly right. So in some cases, it was really helpful to make you understand what exactly it was and how you could relate to it and find it. Yeah. And it later became a yoke around a lot of people's necks.
Right.
Yeah.
But it does come out on this first and this double EP that mm-hmm. there are commonalities, there are differences, but there's sort of a classic definition, and I found one, and
read it.
You know, yep. I found this in an article. It's from a New Zealand journalist named Laura Williamson, and I've read a lot about the Dunedin sound, but to me, this is just a great couple lines about it. Her definition for Dunedin sound is rough but melodic, 60s jingle jangle with a punk rock outlook, structurally innovative, not shy with the keyboards, smart, sometimes melancholy, sometimes comic, often pretty, and, owing to low-tech recording gear, all of it wrapped in a nebulous fuzz. The sonic equivalent of the damp mist that envelops the new region. Listen to this double EP.
Yeah,
the chills. The Chills and the Verlaines have that sort of classic jangle sound to them, wrapped in a lot of mystery.
Yeah.
But you know, the Stones, who are also on this double EP, and the Stones just name themselves the Stones. You know, again, no worries there, no
name.
Copyright concern. They're more of a punk outfit. And the fourth side of this was Sneaky Feelings.
Yeah.
Who is a band that actually wasn't too thrilled with the DIY thing.
No, they,
for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, they wanted to be a little more produced and
right.
You know, more radio friendly.
I think they were a little bit more Brian Wilson Beach Boys. They had harmonies, and you know, in a four track is hard to do a lot of harmonies.
It sure is. Yeah.
But regardless, they went ahead. The Dunedin double EP was again done on the Chris Knox's four track, mm-hmm. right?
And we were floating space capsule. I look at you.
You knew these records when you heard them, and these songs were from somewhere else, but it was really hard to understand where that was. It just seemed really exotic in the
right.
80s, right?
Yeah,
when you couldn't just like go to Google Maps and, you know,
right.
or like,
right.
you know, look at Lord of the Rings where they filled, you know, some of that stuff and understand what it was.
Really? I mean, I didn't even have a picture in my mind of what any of it looked like.
No, exactly.
But I, from the music, I just always pictured that it was probably raining a lot. It was probably dark a lot.
Yeah.
But a lot of there's a lot of joy and sort of happiness and spunk to the music, and sort of there's that weird mix of the kind of the dark mix and some sort of grunginess, but also this sort of like ultimately kind of optimistic.
I would encourage you guys to go and look up this record, especially for the cover, because it was all done, you know, completely different. And to your point, Nick, if you look at the Stones side of the record, they literally just pasted some photos over the top of Exile on Main Street's inner sleeve.
Right, right. I love that.
That's our cover.
It's cheeky.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And all those hand-drawn, you know, labels, everything black and white, and it's just super exotic, and there was just nothing like it at the time. And we're pretty into this label.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. And is there anything else you'd sort of add to that kind of origin story and how it got to the Dunedin Double EP?
You know, we're kind of going through this chronologically.
We are.
But as American kids in college picking up this music from American labels that were, you know, licensed to release these albums, the chronology is all messed up.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have known that Dunedin Double EP was sort of in 82 when the first thing.
Right.
Because a lot of these songs appear in different anthologies. They come in and out. But they all, you know, they have that vibe. They have that sound. And so the chronology wasn't, you know, I'm a big chronology geek when it comes to music.
Oh,
no doubt
too.
About it.
Yeah.
But for some reason, this never troubled me too much because it was just so high quality. It was of a piece. It was distinct. And, you know, it didn't matter so much when it came out.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it would always feel like, I remember the first time I heard the song Joed Out by the Verlaines.
Yeah.
And I could not tell you when it was made. I just didn't know. Yeah. It could have been made any time from like the mid 60s to right now.
It's timeless. And I would argue, and for those of you who've listened through this whole thing and are intrigued, I really think it holds up. It just doesn't sound dated to me at all.
But you're right. It didn't matter so much what album was first or what album was second. But later, as adults, that's why it still holds up for me. And it's so rich that you can go back and still kind of piece this all together. And when I go on my Discogs want list, the one thing I don't have is the Dunedin Double original copy of it.
Get.
Oh, yeah. And the prices are high. I think the last one sold for $175.
Wow.
Yeah. I would have to be sleeping in the backyard, folks, for a week or two if I pulled the trigger on that one.
Right.
Okay, we got to get out of here because this has been great. Nick, thank you so much for doing this, and we're going to keep this going all week. And hopefully you guys will find bands that you haven't heard before or some lost stuff here as we go through the week. But just want to do the closing business here. So Jim is not here, so I'm going to do my best. You can be my witness, Nick. I wrote the phone number down to the Suburban
it's
Party
on the
line
paper.
So I would get it right. So you can find a list of the songs we played today and some info. Maybe we'll ask Nick if we can publish the quote and some excerpts here from his excellent outline. Find that at suburbspod.com. We're all over the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @suburbspod. You can email us, rock@suburbspod.com. But the best thing to do, Nick, what's the very best thing to do?
Is to call.
Call the Suburban Party line. It's
612-440-1984.
And you're going to want to do that because you're listening to the show every day.
Every day, right?
That's right, yes. Every day.
In this case, Monday.
Yeah, that's right. It is Monday. Right. It's been a long Monday, but we thank you guys for hanging with us. Hopefully, Craig walked Milo for a really long time today. And it's Rockin' the Suburbs. We thank you guys for listening. I'm Patrick Foster.
Nick Sclera.
We will talk to you guys tomorrow. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I just got up, and I'm feeling seedy. Sun does squeeze through the living, and it's all too bright, and it's thin and reedy. The windows pop with a greenish light from the previous night. The bottles shine, and all the heaters glow in the middle of the snow. We are in a stranger's room, but it isn't strange, cause it's so familiar. Ceilings cracked and a weird perfume creeps around the walls, and it seems to fill ya with a depressing sense of the here too far as you open the door. The outside shut is in, and you have to go to the safety of the snow. I
I have not got the strength to leave, but I feel down deep that I really need to. Something's hooked me by the sleeve, and the cup which rears its ugly head to say things I've never heard in my life before.
They hadn't made much money.